This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Children who start using e-cigarettes are twice likely to become regular tobacco users. That's dangerous. It risks the renormalization of tobacco in society.
That was Vinayak Prasa, the head of the World Health Organization's Tobacco Control Program. On e-cigarettes and other novel nicotine and tobacco products, threatening progress in the fight against tobacco use. Details coming up. Also, Tunisia, the young North African democracy, the cradle of the Arab Spring, is now facing a constitutional crisis. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Khalifa Haftar, commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, is urging people to register for the December elections and warned that his forces would stand firmly against efforts to prevent anyone from practicing their voting rights. In a meeting with loyalists, Haftar agreed to mobilize support for his election campaign by introducing himself as the only true leader of Libya. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Porchtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
Khalifa Haftar is well aware that the outcome of the elections will most likely not be in favor of his main enemy, of his main opponents, the Islamists. The Brotherhood and the other Islamists on the other side obviously also do not expect to succeed in the elections anytime soon, especially after the events in Tunisia during the last days. And therefore, they try to delay them. Prominent Islamist leader Khalid al-Mishri and the High Council of State demand a referendum about the draft constitution, which would delay the elections almost endlessly. This is no surprise, as after the elections, the High Council of State would cease to exist, so they want to postpone them as much as possible. And for Haftar and for the others, it's clear, the more people are going to vote, the more likely is a defeat of the Islamists. And this makes it this time easy for Haftar to be in line with the demands of ANSMIL, the Americans, and the other international community.
The chief of the Libyan High Commission for the Elections said if the election laws based on the constitutional basis did not arrive by August 1st, there would be only parliamentary elections and presidential elections would be postponed for a month. Is that feasible?
High National Election Commission Chairman Emad El-Sayeh intends, or better, he proposes to have the elections in December on the basis of what is available and what is in force right now. And this is more or less the amended constitutional declaration from 2011, which was already used as a foundation for the parliamentary elections in 2012 and 2014. These constitutional declarations and the amendments do not foresee presidential elections. Therefore, it would be necessary to amend them to allow also for electing a president. However, I would not bet that there would be an agreement about the laws for presidential elections anytime soon, especially if one seeks also the consent of the Libya Political Dialogue Forum and the High Council of State. But if there is no such an agreement, the High Council of State will reject the elections and probably urge to boycott them, and this would certainly undermine the outcome of the elections right away, even before they took place.
Loyalists of Khalifa Haftar in eastern Libya launched a campaign to collect names and national identification numbers as well as electoral centers and mobilize numbers of people to vote for Haftar in the upcoming presidential elections in Libya. In a meeting earlier this month with loyalists, Haftar agreed to mobilize support for his election campaign by presenting himself as the only true leader of Libya. Would that work?
Well, not so sure. Haftar loyalists try to urge people to register for elections as they expect them to vote for their candidate and not for any other civil rights activist or others opposing him and the Libyan National Army. But the decision about the president will certainly not be made only in the East. And with regard to the data breaches, while I have no doubt that it is certainly true that there are illegal data breaches, One must keep in mind that those who are spreading the information about this in the social media are those people who want to undermine the credibility of the outcome of the elections from the very beginning. I expect these activities will increase in the next months, especially, as said, on social media. And this makes it even more important for the international community to provide a proper supervision of the elections. Hefter is right now trying to find out how much support he can expect, not only in the East, but throughout the country, if he would run. And he would run certainly only if he has a very realistic chance to win. It is difficult to assess after more and more people, I assess, are disappointed by the current Abeba government if he would have such a chance. And as far as I understand, he did not yet decide about it. I would say his decision cannot be expected before everything is set for the presidential elections and the criteria for the candidates are here. But as I said at the beginning, in his situation, I would not be too enthusiastic to believe to win the elections. There are certainly others who would have probably better chances than Hefter.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawi. Tunisia's President Kais Saied's sudden dismissal of the Prime Minister and suspension of Parliament has thrust the North African country into a constitutional crisis, according to the French news agency AFP. With the backing of the army, Saied also fired the defense and justice ministers. Opponents are describing the president's actions as a coup in the young democracy that served as the cradle of the Arab Spring. From around the world, nations are voicing their concerns. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke by telephone with Saied to urge respect to democracy and asked him to maintain open political dialogue with all political actors and the Tunisian people. The European Union called on respect for the constitution. The Arab League expressed complete support for the Tunisian people. France urged a return as soon as possible to the normal functioning of government in Tunisia. And Amnesty International urged the president to protect and respect human rights, including free expression, association, and peaceful assembly. Some of South Africa's most astute political thinkers say many of the international community are unfairly writing the country off in the wake of recent public violence. Looting and destruction of property in parts of two provinces followed the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma for his refusal to testify at an inquiry into alleged corruption during his tenure between 2009 and 2018. One analyst says her country should be respected for the way it's handled the crisis. Darren Taylor reports.
As a woman in her mid-20s, Melanie Verwoerd was elected as a member of South Africa's first democratic parliament in 1994. She was a powerful symbol of a new South Africa, a young white Afrikaner woman who supported Nelson Mandela's mostly black ruling African National Congress, or ANC. She was also related by marriage to the man despised by most citizens as the grand architect of apartheid, former white supremacist Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd. She says the recent unrest in South Africa has largely been portrayed around the world as a country going up in flames, when in reality it was confined to parts of only two provinces.
People almost waited all these years for South Africa to go the way that so many other developing or African countries in particular go. That did not happen. And it's really important to say that. There was a challenge here. There was a boil that burst.
The elements in that festering boil, says Verwoerd, are poverty, inequality and mass unemployment, exploited by Zuma's supporters to cause as much chaos as possible, to perhaps even topple the government. She says the plan failed because of the leadership of President Cyril Ramaphosa.
He came in for a lot of flak, but in my view, it was really important to have a cool-headed leader like him during this time. If we had a trigger-happy, dominating, patriarchal type of leader, we would have seen a lot more deaths and the thing would have escalated. Instead, what it did is
just like in 1994, Verwoerd maintains the race war, often predicted for South Africa, didn't happen.
The people of the country came together across racial lines. This did not end up becoming a big racial fight in South Africa. The fact that it was taxi drivers who went into townships and said, you will not loot. It was people who came across the racial lines and set up roadblocks. And ultimately, that's now people across the racial lines who are cleaning up the country.
She says her fellow citizens should feel bizarrely proud about passing one of their most serious tests since 1994, because if ever there was a time when South Africa could have exploded, it was now.
I do believe that in a way the world should actually look at South Africa in awe and say that despite what happened in the last week and a half, 2 weeks, that we could pull ourselves back as a country from the abyss.
Verwoerd says South Africa is a special country because it deals with so many modern global challenges.
We deal with the issues of inequality. We deal with racial challenges and diversity. We deal with the issues of a very fragmented and problematic past. And then we deal with all the other issues like climate change, pandemic, etc., on the same level, perhaps even just more on steroids, because we do not have enough economic power to buffer the fallouts of it. And thus it is important always.
In this context, says Verwoerd, the world will continue to look at and learn from South Africa's reaction to crises such as the recent violence. She says the country's long been a global symbol of both horror and hope, and this isn't going to change anytime soon. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, reports at least 57 migrants drowned after their boat capsized off the Libyan shore yesterday. It says 18 survivors, all from West African countries, are in a state of shock and traumatized by the experience. IOM tells VOA it fears the survivors could end up in abusive detention centers in Libya. The World Health Organization warns e-cigarettes and other novel nicotine and tobacco products threaten progress in the fight against tobacco use across the globe. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Many countries are making progress in adopting tobacco control measures to get their populations to quit smoking or to dissuade them from starting to smoke. But a new World Health Organization report finds governments are no match for the tobacco industry. For the first time, the WHO is presenting new data on electronic delivery systems such as e-cigarettes and heated tobacco products. The head of WHO's tobacco control program, Vinayak Prasad, tells VOA the tobacco industry is marketing these products to children and adolescents. He says e-cigarettes, which come in more than 15,000 different flavors, are being promoted to appeal to young people and get them hooked.
But only three countries have banned the use of flavors, and rest don't. Also, 42% of the countries only restrict sale to minors, so children are able to buy e-cigarettes, saying that children who start using e-cigarettes are twice likely to become regular tobacco users. That's dangerous. It risks the renormalization of tobacco in society.
WHO reports the proportion of people using tobacco has declined in most countries. However, the total number of people smoking remains stubbornly high because of population growth. The UN Health Agency estimates the number of current smokers at 1 billion. It adds 8 million people die prematurely from tobacco-related illnesses every year. Prasad says more than 80% of tobacco users live in developing countries. He says the tobacco industry is fighting to prevent countries from adopting regulations against the use of so-called smokeless products.
Biggest challenge of today is the tobacco industry coming out with products at a very high frequency, claiming it to be cleaner, safer, less harmful, and putting the governments under a lot of pressure.
There is limited evidence that electronic devices are effective in weaning people off tobacco. WHO recommends the use of conventional quitting regimens. It also advises governments to implement regulations to stop non-smokers from starting. It says conventional tobacco control measures can be effective in protecting young people from the harmful use of e-cigarettes. These include raising taxes, pictorial health warnings, and bans on advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As farmers struggle to recover from the devastating impact of COVID-19, a pioneering program backed by the Rockefeller Foundation is promoting the use of insect-based feeds among smallholders as a pathway to improving their livelihoods. In Kenya, black soldier fly farming is gaining momentum, as VOA's Ruben Chama reports from the country's eastern town of Machakos.
On a farm in Machakos County on the outskirts of the Kenyan capital Nairobi, Shem Ariwi and his wife Doreen Mbaya are determined to overcome the rising costs of poultry feed. The couple is among more than 2,000 small-scale farmers in Kenya who have been trained to set up insect-based enterprises. Some help has also come from the local Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology, or JKUAT, as Ariwi explains.
We've always been rearing poultry. When you rear poultry, the feed itself is a very big component of the cost of production. And we've always been looking for ways to reduce the cost of production. So we approached JKUAT, who were running a program training people how to raise crickets to be used as animal feed. They trained us on that and also told us about the black soldier flies. They recommended black soldier fly because it has a much higher production return.
Breeding the black soldier fly also contributes tremendously to reducing food waste from the environment. Tons of food waste are now being recycled to feed the larvae. The UN says over 1 billion tons of food produced globally gets lost or wasted every year. The Rockefeller Foundation supported the Nairobi-based International Center for Insect Physiology and Ecology, or ICIPE, with a grant of $600,000. It is testing business models for scaling insect-based feed for poultry and fish farming in Kenya. Chrysantas B. Tanga is a research scientist at ICIPE. He specializes in insects for food, feed, and other uses.
We have been pioneering this area of research since 2013. The first population of the insect was spotted here in Kenya after doing a lot of survey across the country. And then since then, we've been training farmers over this period of time.
He says a recent study carried out by ICIPE in Kenya demonstrated that a number of insects, including the black soldier fly and crickets, can be safely fed to chicken without compromising food safety standards. Poultry, pig, and fish rearing are among the fastest growing agricultural subsectors in Africa. Tanga says that has helped to improve households' livelihood and income levels.
This serves as a source of income to some of the smallholder farmers that make up more than 80% of the farming population. And to some, it serves as opportunities for job. And so this has greatly reduced the poverty levels in the country.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says smallholder farmers in Africa are witnessing an increase in the price of animal feed. Protein ingredients in the market are not only expensive to produce, but their production cycles can have a strong negative impact on the environment, as the Cameroonian-born scientist explains.
This is quite understandable because, one, it competes with human nutrition, and the area of arable land is dwindling drastically because of climate change, and there's overfishing in the oceans, and so there's that scarcity that has tend to cause increase in the price of these major protein sources.
Tanga says the initiative has entered its second phase, which includes scaling up and finding market linkages that will benefit farmers. So far, he says, through donor funding, over 11,000 farmers have been trained across Africa, adding that plans are underway to expand to different countries, including Uganda and Rwanda, among others. Kenyan officials say developing insect-based feed is in line with the government's development blueprint on agro-processing and on providing food and nutrition for all citizens. Ruben Chama, reporting for VOA News from Machakos, Kenya.
Africa scored several preliminary victories in the Olympic boxing tournament yesterday as the Tokyo Games entered their first full week, but also saw the lone woman boxer from Somalia ousted. Ramala Said Ahmed Ali lost her featherweight bout 0-5 to Maria Claudia Nechita of Romania, while another female boxer, Kolaoud Halima Moulahi of Tunisia, lost 0-5 to Sena Airi of Japan, also in the featherweight class. In hockey, South Africa's women's teams lost their second game of the tournament to Great Britain 1-4. But in the rugby sevens, their male compatriots beat Ireland 33-14. The Kenyan men fell to the U.S. rugby sevens team 19-14. Algerian middle distance champion Taufik Makhloufi has pulled out of the games because of a knee injury. He captured the gold in the 1500 meter race in 2012 and took silver medals in 1800 meters and 1500 meters in Rio de Janeiro in 2016. Zimbabwean swimmer Peter Wetzolar placed 42nd in the preliminary rounds in the men's 100 meter freestyle Tuesday with a time of 50.31 seconds. In women's basketball, the United States topped Nigeria 81-72. The Nigerian women kept the pressure throughout the game and were leading 20-17 at the end of the first quarter. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the interview.